Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So I've been away for 3 weeks, I think. I went to teach a retreat in Latvia. Everyone knows where Latvia is. Near Sweden, near Russia, north of Lithuania, south of Russia, east of Sweden, on the Baltic Sea. It's not people. Interesting how people like Latvia, where they place it sometimes. I think it's in the Balkans or all kinds of places. Anyway, my parents are refugees in 1944. My mother and dad fled. My mom was about 30 when the Russians were occupying Latvia, and they knew that if they stayed, they would go to the gulags because they were intelligentsia. So they managed to get a refugee boat to Germany at the last year of the war. My brother was born 2 months before the war ended, or a month before. And then I was born in 47 near Stuttgart. And, so we were kind of refugee type folk. And then in 52 we came to Canada. So a typical kind of Canadian story, refuge, you know, Latvian language at home, English on the street. And so obviously the perception of Latvia is very, very strong in my mind. And then in 1997 or 98, after the Soviets said, the Soviet Empire collapsed really, I had a chance to finally visit Latvia. And I went with Nick Scott, who looks like Tolstoy. You know what Tolstoy looks like, you know what Nick Scott looks like. And we went on a lovely trip from Warsaw to St. Petersburg. It took us about 2 months, taking public transport, just local trains and local buses. And on that trip we did a two or three week walk across a part of Latvia where my grandparents had a kind of big summer place. So we visited that. And then on that visit we had one contact in Riga, and then that multiplied and people got interested in, hey, there's a Buddhist monk in town. And so I gave some teaching, and then they said, could you come next year? And so I came the following 3 years and taught retreats there. Now they've got a really solid little group. And there have been other monks and nuns going to visit. And actually they bought some other Tibetan groups and Burmese groups. And some disciples of Paul Oksaido. I don't know if you know him. He's a famous Burmese teacher, very, very famous. And they bought him 1,000 hectares of land. And I think a hectare is 2.5 acres. And they're, you know, I don't know what we're going to do with all that land. Unfortunately, it's full of mosquitoes. So they apparently did a retreat there and everyone got eaten. But there's a considerable amount of interest. And so this group has been going since then, and they invited me to do a 10-day retreat. And we they rent a school up near the Estonian border. They've been renting it now for 7 years. And it's interesting how they're okay, pretty okay for sharing spaces. So there's one room for women, one room for men, mattresses all over the floor, and then there's some separate rooms, offices. So everyone's doubled up, tripled up, or quadrupled up in different rooms. And it's relatively inexpensive, so they can do that. And So for me, it was really nice to hear the Latvian language. I'm fluent enough that I don't have an accent, apparently. That's what they say. Although one person said I had a Toronto accent. She had an interesting how they say that the diaspora Latvians, because the Latvian hasn't been admixed with Russian, so Russia occupied Latvia since 1944, so some of the Russian intonations have sort of, I think, come into Latvian. And then the Latvian in these diaspora places is a bit older, hasn't gone through that transition. Anyway, and this woman had an auntie in Toronto. She said I had a Toronto accent. But my Latvian's not good enough to teach. But it was very, very odd hearing. It's funny hearing people speak Latvian in Latvia. What else would they speak? Mm-hmm. And then think, God, they speak good Latvian. And then like hearing a 4-year-old speak good Latvian, he can speak better than me. That's, you know, logically, you know, that's the only way it could be. But what is it, emotionally or something? It's really funny to watch. So I really enjoy hearing. And I was teaching with an interpreter who was very good. The guy was really excellent. So just hearing him say, translate what I was saying from English into Latvian, was, you know, I learned a few words that way. And then, so we did, we had about between 40 and 45 people on the retreat, so it was a good number. And then 2 days before I came back, which would have been on the Tuesday, I had asked people to try to organize a boat. I had some of Mom's ashes still and took them out to the Baltic Sea. So we went out to the open sea. There's a big bay of Riga, which is more calm. We went out to the open sea, and they had rented a lovely open boat for us, and we went out for about a kilometer, and then I spread Mom's ashes. The interesting thing, that was just pure joy. There's no nostalgia or sorrow. It's just like this beautiful sunny day and Mom's ashes. They had made a basket of flowers and flower petals. I just dumped the flower petals in the sea and they floated past because the boat was moving along. And the boat had an electric motor, so it was very pop, 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 very, very quiet. So that was quite touching. And then I got on the plane to Frankfurt, spent 5 hours in Frankfurt Airport, and arrived here. So that was, yeah, very special. And one of the things I sent the committee an email. Latvia has a tradition of folk music, and on the weekend that our retreat ended, there was the end of a big 10-day folk music festival, which happens every 5 years in Latvia. And in the diaspora times, in the time when the Soviets were there, it used to happen, like in Toronto, it happened 1 year. They used make-believe gardens as the concert center, and 1 year it was in Seattle, but now it's always in Riga. And the choir, so they have choir competitions. They have choirs from all over the world singing Latvian folk songs. And Latvia has a tradition of folk music which predates the Christian occupation. Christian occupation. That's one way to put it. Christian conversion or whatever, which is in the 12th century through the German knights, through the sword. But they have a folk music tradition which goes back before that. So the music is, the songs are very grounded in nature, grounded in the trees and in the water and in the sun and in the flowers. And there's a lot of Dharma in that. And so these songs are, and this folk tradition are what unifies the country. And so every 5 years they have this song and dance festival. For the dance festival, which happened on the Saturday night, and the song final concert, and then the song concert is on the Sunday night, and on the dance concert they had 14,000 dancers. You know, they were doing break dancing. 14. And what they do is they had a big field and they shifted, they'd shift about like 500 to 1,000 people on and off with folk singers singing. And then the song concert, they had over 24,000 in the choir. And the way, I sent some folks some pictures, but the way they do it is they have a special amphitheater in a park which is built for this. And the amphitheater is just one side with seats all the way up. And then they shift about 5,000 people at a time. And then the conductor gets up on a platform and directs the song. And they change the conductor for each song. And the way they manage, well, how, you kind of think, well, how do they know which songs, right? Well, they publish a songbook 5 years before the concert. And then this songbook is distributed over, 350 parishes in Latvia and through all the diaspora, through all the different Latvian centers. So they all learn the same songs. And then they come together every 5 years and they have song competitions because the songs are by age group and by difficulty and dance competitions. And they have winners and so on. And then they have this final concert. And in the final of the last hour of the dancing and the last hour of the singing, they have everyone comes on. And then they open up the park and because they had 24,000 singers and 26,000 listeners. And then they, when the concert is over, they just open up the gates and then I think half of Riga goes in and dances. So they're dancing till dawn. So I saw some of that on television. They're really kind of very moving, you can imagine. And to see something in a culture which is kind of very unifying, it's not based on religion, not based on sport. I was thinking what unifies most cultures, like a Buddhist culture, it would be Vaisak. In Thailand, it would be Vaisak, Katina, things like that. In Canada, it's probably when Canada plays America in Olympic hockey. And what else? You know, what else is this? That's the sort of, I guess there's other things Canada did. So that was quite a moving experience. And so now I'm here, back here. But what's very strong, I think, when one travels like that and think back to my own history, is the whole very nature of perception. And I've been contemplating perception a lot, how important that is and how much our world is built up of perceptions. We couldn't live without perceptions. So when I just, like if I use the word Latvia, where each of us is a different meaning, obviously for me it's probably a much richer or more complex meaning than for you. And so although we have concepts and words, Latvia is just kind of a geographical place, it's also loaded with meaning. And that's one of the ways we consider the very idea of perception of sanya in the five khandhas, or the way the Buddha asked us to contemplate the nature of our conscious experience. So if I identify with being a Latvian, that's a strong identification for me. So there's not only the perception of Latvia with all its historical loading that I have, but there's also a sense of identity with it. And then I see another Latvian, I hear maybe Latvian in the airport, and I think, oh, how nice to hear Latvian. But also I might identify with being Latvian, and I also identify myself as being maybe oppressed by the Soviets. So then I hear Russian accent, I'll never forgive them. I feel bitterness towards Russia. Right? And that's all just a construct of mind coming from my own conditioning. And we have these kind of constructs. That's what our world is kind of based upon. So if you think of like just the kind of popular perception, when you say, all right, my glass is half full, or my glass is half empty. That's the perception, isn't it? So you see the glass is half full, half empty. And someone might say to you, "Oh, you know, be an optimist, see your glass is half full." But actually, if you're going across the desert and if you're at the last gas station, it might be good to consider, well, actually, my glass is half empty, I better fill up. So perceptions are a part of the way our inner consciousness works. And the Buddha, first of all, he asked us to see perception as a construct, as something which is not absolute, and something which is tentative and dependent. And as far as identities go, he suggested don't identify with any self-perception. Don't say I'm a Latvian, I'm a Canadian, I'm a man, I'm a woman, any kind of final and fixed way, because it'll always lead to suffering. But perceptions can be used skillfully too. So if you think about the perception sometimes, or the statement that we were all, in some form or other, we've all been mothers and fathers to each other, we've been brothers and sisters to each other. That's the kind of Buddhist statement you find. You find it very often in Mahayana Buddhism. And now if you take that as a sort of fact, take that as a fact, then if you don't have such a strong conditioning around rebirth, then you think, well, come on, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But if you take it as just a kind of a perception, and then I look at other people and I say, well, this person, this woman could have been my mom or my sister, this man could have been my father or my brother, it creates a whole different way of relating to the person. As a fact, you know, maybe. But it does create a different kind of response to the person. And these kind of perceptions, these I think a skillful use of creating a kind of narrative, I suppose, in our life, which is conducive to peace and conducive to compassion, is a skillful way of organizing our worldview, seems to me. So if I, you know, the golden rule, that's another kind of perception, isn't it? Just as I don't like to suffer, you don't like to suffer. Just as you don't like pain, I don't like pain. Just as I don't like to be, I enjoy comfort, you enjoy comfort. That's a particular way of looking at like a common experience. But the other is that you're bigger, you're shorter, you're smaller, you're male, you're female, you're whatever. It's a different perception. So they're not wrong or right, but you might just consider what perceptions are really useful, what are skillful, what are the ways we interpret life that might be helpful in liberation from suffering. And certainly the perceptions of compassion are very, very, very helpful, very skillful. And just kind of constantly bringing those to mind, that the golden rule, bringing that to mind. All the perceptions based on empathy, say, seeing someone who is successful or happy and relating, oh, it must really feel nice to be happy, or it must really feel nice to be successful, or something like that. And you relate rather than through jealousy, or I wish I had that, or they don't really deserve that, or they're just, you know, whatever, they're rich people, they shouldn't have that. That's another way of perceiving it. And this kind of, the mind is generating this stuff all the time, isn't it? It's always going on all the time. And one of the perceptions I find quite useful is just that, like, you consider that as a human being, it's quite odd that you can both be an actor in a stage drama, and you can also be the audience. This is the kind of curious, like, I can feel passionate about something, positive or negative, and I can also notice that I'm feeling passionate about something. I can be the actor in this passionate drama, so I can feel self-righteous, or I can feel enthusiastic, or I can feel annoyed, or I can feel nervous or anxious, and that's the kind of perceptions that might come up into my mind. And also, I can be like in the audience and say, oh, look at that. There's passion, it has arisen. And this capacity to actually be in the audience rather than on the stage is very, very useful. Because that kind of perception is more the perception that actually frees you from always having to be an actor, always being on the stage. So if I, let's say I feel sentimental about being in Latvia, or I feel annoyed at someone who has done something which is inappropriate, that sense of annoyance comes up, and that's one of the actors in the drama. Now when I take that sense of being an actor as personal, that's who I am, then there's no freedom. Because this sense of a person coming up and acting out and being buttons being pushed and old memories coming up is this the constant drama that goes on inside our consciousness. And yet there is the capacity to see that drama as just a drama. It's not who you are. Notice how your sense of a person arises dependent on a context of other people. So if I, let's say that sense of me being a Latvian, when I'm, let's say I'm sitting on a plane and there were Latvian people all around me who were flying from Riga to Frankfurt and I'm hearing the Latvian language, you know, my sense is, oh, I'm a Latvian, I can understand this, that's that. And that sense of being like identified with that group is something that arises with that group, with that sound, with those perception. It's not really separate from it. It's not like I am a Latvian all the time. The sense of being a Latvian, being a certain kind of person, arose with all those inputs. And that arose, and then it changed. And then I get to Toronto, to Ottawa Airport, and then I hear Canadian, and then I kind of have a different idea. You know, Buddhist monk in Canada. Different kind of self arises, or different sense of personality arises. So the drama or the kind of stage that the sense of self manifests on is actually just that. It's just a set of conditions creating a sense of a person, and then that sense of person dies away. When you're with your parents, you know, you have a different perception, self-perception with your children, different self-perception. When you're on your own, different self-perception. So these things come and they go, they come and they go. And there's nothing right or wrong about them, but there is this kind of curious possibility of just seeing, well, it's just a drama, that's just a play coming and going. The way I like to teach, I say that the very sense of me being a Latvian happens in awareness. It's not like I am aware of them and I am Latvian and they are Latvian or they are Polish or they are. It's actually something that arises in awareness, and awareness is always bigger. The sense of being competent or incompetent, being self-righteous, or like, let's say you find some kind of injustice going on in the monastery, in your family, in your community, and you feel self-righteous, that's all wrong, it shouldn't be that way. That arises because of this arises. You know, they're dependent. We call it dependent origination. So the sense of a particular kind of self or an identity depends on the conditions that trigger it, that come up into consciousness. And there's certain kind of identities which are probably more helpful than others. So identities that are very, very, very deluded, like very energies which are very selfish, which are very, very frightened or very, very greedy, get triggered by those kinds of inputs. So if I'm really into consumerism and there's a new, yet another Apple product comes out and I've got all the Apple products and then I see a new Apple product and I see the advert and then my mind becomes the consumer. How am I going to get that? And I'd be really happy if I had that, all the rationalizations about that and so on. And that arises with the stimulus of the consumer or of the advertising. So where to find your freedom? Well, the Buddha suggests, well, first of all, have good identities. You know, identify with the precepts. You know, have really good, strong identity. Identify with non-violence. I'm someone who doesn't kill. Identify with non-corruption. Identify with fidelity. Identify with speech, which is beautiful and harmonious and skillful. Identify with sobriety and so on. Be that, you know, if you're going to take an identity, take those identities. So the Buddha suggests, you know, these are strong identities. I don't kill. I don't steal. I don't do that. It's not something I do. Would you like a joint? No. Sorry, I'm not. I don't go there. Thank you. So those are very, very helpful kind of standards. If they become self-righteous, oh, you smoke dope, you dope head. It might be true the person's a dope head, but you might be a dope for being so self-righteous, right? And pure and goody good. So it's not an identity as such, but it is a perception that is very, very helpful. I don't do that. It's not something I do. Or like perception of generosity, that this is, you know, sort of wholesome to care for other people and share one's resources and so on. These are lovely kind of perceptions to cultivate and develop. And the other perceptions that I'd be really, really happy if I had that, yet that whatever they say I should get, or the kind of complaining perceptions, I'd be really happy if you were different, or all the other kinds of perceptions, those we don't have to identify with. We can see them more and more as unskillful conditions. And that's that when you sit as the audience and you watch this movement in consciousness, you begin to say, that actor, let him die. Don't give him any more lines, you know? just give him a minor part, or just and that's true, isn't it? When those actors, those really bad actors, aren't given any lines, they tend to fade away because they're not fed, they're not nourished, they're not encouraged, they're not believed in. Believed in is, I think, very important. And these other kind of values, really like core values, they are not ego identities, but they're just core values which keep you living in the world of self-referencing, of where I am a person, I'm individual, I have my responsibilities, I have to do work, I have to relate to people, how to do it. Well, you do it from those kinds of wholesome guidelines. But I think I think all of us have a deep sense of ethical commitment, don't we? I mean, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So that's usually not really such a problem. That kind of perception is not really such a problem. But the other kinds of identities, you know, they have, which become problematic, are very much ones where the mind has just become habituated to self-identities, which can seem very, very real, but they're just actors on the stage. And to not give them credence, to not feed them, is the way of being more in the audience. You can be in the audience more. And it's because quite often there's no real reason to be a person. You know, there's no, you don't have to act right now. Actually, there's no play going on. You just be empty. But, you know, you think about like the times where we could be empty, where we can just be with the way things are and not really have to project a persona or anything. Why does the sense of self keep coming up? You know, I'm just innocently walking through a forest and blah, 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 blah. Sense of self is going on. Well, why does that acting need to go on? Well, I think we'd say basically because the mind needs focus, the mind needs training, and that's the whole other kind of side of a Buddhist lifestyle, where we learn how to more and more drop all the self identities and live in the present moment, and that's tremendously difficult to do, but living in the present moment is a way of both being the audience, not identifying with the players, and then actually learning how to turn the TV off. You know, because the whole sense of, like, I think Jim Howe called it Jim TV on the retreat. Remember that retreat? Jim, we asked him, how's it going, Jim? He said, oh, a lot of Jim TV today. Blah, 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 kind of going on and on and on. So that's just sort of like a habit or a momentum. And quite often what happens is rather than just turn the TV off, we go to another channel. A channel might be like self-criticism or compensation. So we go from feeling, a bit depressed to eating ice cream, which is all right. There's nothing immoral about that. But it's just kind of replacing one object for another. And we're still on the stage, actually. And we're still kind of playing the game. But when we step back and we know, oh, the very sense of a person and the sense of a self is actually just that. It's just an object of mind. It's something that ceases in the mind. We begin to appreciate the silence of the mind, which is not dependent in the same way on these interactions that we have. So that like I can experience the happiness of like conviviality and generosity with a group of people. And I certainly like experienced that in Latvia just now. It's really delightful to be taken care of. It's really, really delightful. But that's very dependent, isn't it? That kind of delight. And we can, if we live our life skillfully with other people, we can maximize that to some extent. But we all know that that in itself is not reliable. That kind of uplift that we get from friendship and good companionship and so on, and good sociability is very much dependent on those conditions. So we do the best to create those conditions of harmony. So we live morally, we live generously, we do the very, very best. But there has to be more than that, because that is very much subject to causing conditions, to all kinds of things. So I might feel, a very kind of friendly atmosphere, and everyone's nice to me, and I have a migraine. Right? Or everyone seems to be nice to me, and then someone says, Buddhists are a bunch of twits. Where'd you come from? And then I'm injured and shocked or whatever. Didn't happen. But certainly, I remember once I was at a kind of ecumenical, I think it was a book launch in London. It was really weird. Kind of, I don't know how I got in there. But there were like, I think it was more like a Tibetan kind of thing, and we went as representatives of Amaravati. And I was very open-hearted, And this guy came up to me, and he just went for my jugular. He said, you terrible Vada Buddhists are killing people. I said, what? And he was talking about the difficulties in Sri Lanka. And it was interesting, because I was so open-hearted, I was totally vulnerable. And I didn't know where it came from, and I just walked away feeling kind of shattered. It was very interesting to see how, first of all, be careful, and how something like that, kind of, what do we call it, blindsided, huh? I got totally blindsided, and I felt really, really quite shocked. And that life is that way, but then what do you do with that? Well, I want to basically kick the guy in the head, but I refrained. I didn't say anything. I didn't understand what he's talking about, actually. I didn't know where he was coming from. I'm innocent. I haven't done anything. And then I walked away from it, and the echo of that was emotionally quite powerful for like about a half an hour, and then all through the week that kept coming up. And that's just part of the drama. It was like a really bad soap opera that day for me. And so we get these kinds of inputs that come, and sometimes they're smooth and harmonious, and something they're like really shocking, what hit you? So but the more you take the position of being in the audience, the more I think the less one gets hooked into that stuff, and I think the more quickly one resolves it. And so I find that perception is quite a subtle perception, it's not that obvious, but it is a kind of thing. And the way I do that is I just, like I think you know how I like to teach meditation. So I'll say, listen to sound, feel your body. Listen to sound, feel your body. And I'll do that. And then I say, that's happening in awareness. And that, for me, it shifts my attention from being You know, I'm hearing the sounds out there, or I'm in the body, or I'm in my head, and it all shifts it to, oh yeah, this is happening in awareness. So awareness begins to take a dimension which is not in that. It's of that kind. It's kind of participating in it, around it, above it, bigger than it. I don't know quite how to explain it. And that's a perception. You know, it's a way of kind of perceiving, well, this is happening in awareness. Now, if you take that as a philosophy, you know, that awareness is the all-encompassing consciousness that includes all sentient beings with loving law, you know, kind of you go on like that, then that becomes some kind of philosophical absolute. But rather than a belief or whatever, it's a perception. You know, it's a way of like, it's a perspective to consider this happening in awareness. Or the like, so Viradhammo as injured person is one of the actors on this drama, or melodrama in that case, comes and goes according to causes and conditions. And if that is my only identity as the emotional person, as the person who gets excited or depressed or whatever, then of course I'm a victim to the other actors that come on stage because I'm not independent. That's a drama that I just keep getting drawn into. But if I find that perspective of awareness of change, and this is the perception that the Buddha and Ajahn Chah say, we were just reading his stuff this morning, constantly encourages that the perception of change. Now, the perception of change as opposed to the belief that everything changes. Now, that's different. I think like Buddhists believe that that everything changes, or that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. And that's true, but to actually do it, to actually do that perception or bring that perception up to the mind is the same as, you know, I'm feeling hard done by and I look at my glass and, well, there's only half a glass left, as opposed to, well, you've got half a glass. And that's the perception. That's a way of looking at that situation, right? And that's different than believing I should always be optimistic. You know, I should be optimistic is a kind of ego statement. Whereas the perception of glass half full, glass half empty is something that can be employed. It could be employed skillfully or unskillfully. So the perception of change is something the Buddha's teaching is asking us to make alive. And Ajahn Chah, you read his teachings constantly. It's uncertain, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. He said, take everything, it's uncertain. Now, you can only see the effectiveness of that if you do it. Right? You only see what he's talking about if you think, oh, that'll be interesting, I'll try that. I'll try what actually happens, and I'll observe the actors and the players and dramas in this inner world of mine and the outer world, and I'll see what happens if each time a perception comes up and say, oh, this is uncertain. And what that does for me, it always puts me more in that witnessing audience kind of consciousness. So there can still be the actor who has to fulfill responsibilities and go to meetings and get through airports and do all of that. But the more that perspective of open-hearted attention, shall we say, or audiencing, you find a kind of peacefulness within this drama, within this movement. The movement's still there. It has to be. And because we are sense beings, we have that. So just like going through airports and just kind of seeing there's the drama of people hassling you and, you know, taking your shoes off and searching you and lineups and immigration and all of that. And yeah, this is the play that goes on. So the play has to go on. I can't just kind of sit in the luggage compartment and be in emptiness. You know, I have to get my luggage, I have to get my passport stamped and so on. But there's also that possibility of seeing this happening, arising and ceasing. So both are going on. Sometimes people think that, you know, if you do this practice of non-grasping or not attached, that's what we're talking about, you're somehow kind of totally spaced out and incompetent and capable of functioning in a normal world. But not so. I think the capacity to function becomes actually more clear, because one is much more aware of what's appropriate and inappropriate. So I was kind of joking with the people there, like my perception of I am a Latvian. There's a very good tennis player who always gets to the kind of first round of Wimbledon but never gets beyond that, he's a Latvian named Gulbis. He's actually from a very rich family, apparently, and a good tennis player, but hasn't got quite the killer instinct, I suppose. So when I discovered, I said, "Hey, Mom, there's a Latvian on in tennis." "Oh, yeah." So you get this kind of thing. "Oh, yeah, may he win. And then he gets beat by a Russian. Oh, terrible, I got beat by a Russian. It's just a self-creation. It's totally, if someone has no history with Russians or Latin, big deal, right? Who cares? And so, you know, I could just see, like, or a Latvian in the Olympics, or like you see, like there's a famous Latvian goalie for some team, Irbis, I think his name was, right? So, wow, yeah. And it's just something being created, a sense of me, a sense of history, what's important. But as soon as I identify with that, then when that somehow falters into something negative, then I suffer too. So as I see, oh, that's just the old Latvian actor. That's fine, but I'm none of that. So I'm not denying that because we have conditioning, but I'm also not taking that as a kind of personal identity because I would just call me suffer. So what identity should you take? Well, you could kind of identify more with awareness, more of the perception of change. You know, that's a different kind of thing. You know, and that's more like taking refuge in Buddha, knowing Dharma. And that's not really an ego identity, it's not a self identity. It's more like, as in this analogy, being part of the audience rather than being one of the players, one of the actors. Okay, I'll leave that for you to consider.
Andamayang ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karanda dhamma se
sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, shall we finish with a closing chant?